This interview was originally part of the Jodcast. For the full show, please visit www.jodcast.net. This is the way two black holes collide, not with a bang, but a... Now, I haven't just deleted an expletive in an interesting way. That is actually the audio representation of the gravitational waves emitted when two black holes collide into each other. To find out more, I interviewed Dr. Graham Wone from the University of Glasgow.
Okay, so I'm a radio astronomer originally. I worked on radio astronomy at quite low frequencies. And about 6 years ago, the work in Glasgow, which is where I'm from, on gravitational wave detection, reached a point where real astronomy may be able to be performed with the instrumentation. And so there was a requirement to get some astronomers interested in gravitational wave research, just purely to get somebody to have a look at the data, analyse it, look for potential sources. And so we work within a collaboration called the LIGO Scientific Collaboration, the LSC. And this is becoming a worldwide arrangement of several hundred scientists. I think the last of the papers had something like 350 authors on it.
Right.
And so it's a fair size. And this is a collaboration which essentially brings together the observations from the three large LIGO gravitational wave detectors in America, and R1 in Hanover, and just becoming now the detector in Italy. So LIGO is the Laser Interferometric Gravitational Observatory. And so the aim is to get a kind of worldwide network of gravitational wave detectors.
So you are an organising consortium, basically.
That's right, yes. It's right now the majority of the high-precision observations are from the detectors in America, the detectors of LIGO, which are in Hanford in the northwest, and there's one in Louisiana in the southeast of America. And those detectors have now been running at design sensitivity for over a year.
Right.
And so they're bringing in the data, and we're just analysing it. Our detector in Hanover is smaller, and as a result, it's not quite so sensitive. But what it brings to the issue is that it has optics and techniques applied within it, which are the techniques which will be used in the next generation of gravitational wave detectors.
It's a test bed, basically,
Well, it's a test bed. It's an observing test bed, so
right.
It's sort of a hybrid of the two. In a few years' time, we'll have a program of other detectors, which are advanced detectors. They're a hybrid of the technology in our detectors in Hanover and the infrastructure of the detectors in America. And so that's what everyone now is working towards, is the construction of these advanced detectors.
Let's talk about what you're actually trying to observe in the first place, these gravitational waves. Now, tell us about
what are gravitational waves?
Yes.
Well, they are, as they say, they are waves of gravity. So what does that mean? Well, it means that if a gravitational wave was to pass over us right now in this room, then the separation between us would slightly change in an oscillating way. So we'd get slightly closer together and slightly further apart. If we were sort of hanging in free fall, obviously we're in chairs, which holds us in position at the moment, but if we were in free fall, we would actually get slightly closer, slightly further apart.
So does that mean that gravity itself is getting stronger, or is something else happening?
Well, the strange thing is, if you were to actually be in free fall in space and the wave went through, you wouldn't actually yourself be able to tell, because it wouldn't feel as if you were being accelerated. It's not like your hat would fly off or anything as you were slid from side to side. What actually happens is just the separation between things changes. And so it's the space-time between things which is becoming stretched and squeezed. And that can be detected. It's a very small effect. The strain, the fractional change in separations, are one part in 10 to the 22, 23, 24 or so. And so these are very, very small changes in separation.
So you're saying the universe itself is actually stretching and contracting as this wave goes past?
Exactly that. It's very much like the analogy which is always used is of a rubber sheet. So imagine you had something like a trampoline, a large trampoline, but made out of quite floppy rubber, so it's not a trampoline you'd actually want to jump on. And you threw a stone onto the trampoline, then you'd get these ripples of elastic waves which would flow out from the place where the stone hit. Well, that's very much like the stretching and the squeezing of of space, which occurs as a gravitational wave flows through it. And so the question is, what's the analogy of throwing a stone onto this trampoline? Well, the analogy is almost anything which throws around a large amount of extra mass. So if you have, say, a pair of neutron stars or any stars orbiting each other, then the act of that orbit actually produces gravitational waves, and the waves flow out at it, actually twice the orbital frequency of the orbit itself.
How do we know that? How do we know that these gravitational waves exist? We know, as far as we know, that we haven't detected any yet, but...
That's right. In fact, despite the fact that we have these great detectors, which in principle can detect gravitational waves, as yet they haven't seen a single wave. So what makes us believe this isn't a complete waste of time and effort? Well, the primary reason, is that we have indirect evidence of the existence of gravitational waves from the way in which they slow down the orbits of neutron stars. So we can see pairs of neutron stars orbiting each other. And if one of these neutron stars is a pulsar, then we can time it very accurately. Mm. And we can see the orbit evolve in time. And what we see is that the orbits slowly shrink, very slowly, just by a fraction of an inch every orbit, but they slowly in spiral.
They're spiraling towards each other.
Towards each other. And what that means is that the orbital system is throwing out energy and angular momentum. That's the only way in which you can explain this. And if you work out how much energy and angular momentum is being radiated from this system, it's exactly the amount predicted in Einstein's theory of general relativity. It's a very precise match to the predicted loss of energy and angular momentum through gravitational radiation. And so that's the real reason why most people, I think everybody now actually, believes that gravitational waves exist, despite the fact we haven't ever detected them as a wave yet.
Why is it that gravitational systems like these binary star systems couple to space-time itself and radiate gravity?
Anything will radiate gravitational waves if you accelerate it. So if you stand up, you accelerate and you will radiate a very small amount of gravitational radiation. That's not very much. The analogy is very close with electromagnetic waves. So you're probably aware that if you have a charge, an electrical charge, and you accelerate that, perhaps in an antenna, or perhaps if you have an electron, perhaps in a wire, and you heat the wire up so that the electron is accelerating very, very rapidly, then this will produce electromagnetic waves, either radio waves for the antenna or light waves if it's a hot wire. Gravitational radiation is exactly the same, and in fact produces quite prestigious amounts of gravitational radiation if you accelerate the mass sufficiently. But these waves are quite hard to detect because the majority of the power in the wave isn't in the strain. Remember earlier we were talking about the way in which it stretches and squeezes the space. Mm-hmm. You can think of space-time as a rubber sheet, but it's very, very strong rubber.
Right.
It's a bit like the rubber of a rubber tire. Mm-hmm. So if you can imagine hitting a rubber tire, a fair amount of energy from your hand ends up in the rubber tire, but the displacement of the rubber is actually rather small.
Right.
And there is a wave. You can imagine there's a wave mm-hmm. travelling out along the rim of the tire, but you can't actually see the displacement. And that's pretty much how it is with gravitational waves. The amount of power in the waves can be quite significant, but the amount of strain, the amount of stretching and squeezing of time and space, which this corresponds to, is actually rather small.
Right.
So our current detectors are having to look for waves which have, how shall I describe it? The fractional change in separation is the same as changing the distance from us to the nearest star, Alpha Centauri, by about 1/100 the width of a human hair.
And you want to detect this?
And we can detect that.
You can detect
this? We can already detect that.
How on earth are you going to detect such a small change?
Well, this is where these machines just become mind-blowingly amazing. So let's imagine, LIGO detectors in Hanford. So what these look like are L shapes on the ground, a pair of arms at right angles, and we shine a laser beam up each of these arms, reflected off the end, and some other optics between, actually. And then we time how long, essentially, the laser beam takes to return. And if one arm is slightly stretched or squeezed with respect to the other arm, then there's a slight change in the light travel time. And this appears as a shift in the position of an interference fringe. Right. In this interferometer, it's an interferometric system. And the amount of displacement of an arm, which we can see, is something like 10 to the minus 18 of a metre in a second.
Right.
So just to put that into perspective, as the width of an atom is about 10 to the minus 10 of a metre, and the width of a proton is about 10 to the minus 15 of a metre. So we're talking about a thousandth the width of a proton.
Wow.
And this is a machine which can detect a displacement change of that in a second. And, of course, because these arms are long, that means their strain sensitivity is about 1,000 times higher than that. Mm. And so they can detect strains of 10 to the minus 21, 22, 23, depending on the frequency. So they are phenomenal machines. And how do we know that we can detect these things? Well, you can actually inject a little signal. So you can electrostatically or electromagnetically slightly change the position of one of the optical components in the system. So right. Imagine the one you're reflecting off the end of one of the arms. So you can adjust that position by something like 10 to the minus 18 of a meter, which you can do amazingly.
That's spectacular. And so you're simulating the effect of a passing gravitational wave by doing this.
Exactly.
Just to test the equipment.
That's right. And then you can extract that from the data which you observe. And we've tried that. We've essentially injected the signals, waveforms, which are like the ones which we expect from real astrophysical sources. And we've checked that we can recover them from the data with mm-hmm. the sensitivity which we expect, and we can. So we're pretty confident that the detectors are operating as hoped. All we need now is for there to be a strong source of gravitational waves in our immediate vicinity.
Right. A layman's view of how you're doing this, you're trying to measure these tiny, tiny changes in difference between these two mirrors in your interferometer, one arm of interferometer. Mm-hmm. But you're saying that the effect of a passing gravitational wave is to stretch and then contract local space ever so slightly. But in layman's terms, you're trying to measure this distance with some kind of ruler. Doesn't that mean your ruler is stretching and contracting as well?
You've got to be careful with this, as you say. So how it works is that we shine up these arms, we shine a light, and it's the proper time that light takes to travel the distance between the ends, which is the entity which we detect. And so imagine you looked at one of the crests of the light and you saw how long it took to get from the sort of hub of the L out to the end of the arm and return. That's what we're detecting. So it really is the light travel time.
Right.
But you can get confused because you're quite right. You may think that the wavelength of the light stretches as well as the wave heads through. Well, that's essentially describing the same effect from another frame, so you've got to be careful you're not sort of unwinding the effect which you've described in another way earlier. The other way to imagine it, and I think actually this is slightly easier, is to think about it in more cosmological terms. So we think about the expanding universe, and everyone's heard of the expanding universe now, and that's detected by the redshift of spectral lines from objects a long way away. And that redshift is because the separation between us and them is increasing. It's, mm-hmm. It's the expansion of the universe. Well, on a much smaller scale, it's exactly what is happening in these interferometers. It's the separation between the beginning and the end of the arm, which is increasing. The only change for us is that it then gets smaller again. It oscillates in and out.
Right.
But it's a bit like a redshift and a blue shift from the end of the arm.
Right.
So that's another way of imagining it, which perhaps is a little bit easier.
Speaking of oscillations, what's the frequency of a gravitational wave?
Well, pretty much anything you like. The real question you want to ask is, what's the frequency of strong gravitational waves?
Fair enough.
And the detectors we have at the moment work round about the audio range, oddly. They're about between about 25 to 50 hertz up to a few kilohertz.
Right.
And so if one actually plugged the output of the detectors into a pair of headphones, which we do, in fact,
yes.
because it's an extremely instructive exercise, then what you hear is hiss. And that hiss is the hiss from the detector. But if a wave went through the detector, you'd actually hear the wave itself. And so we have some recordings which show, and perhaps we could put some of these on your website.
Absolutely.
Which are examples of what these rather cataclysmic and spectacular events in the universe actually would sound like in the gravitational wave detectors. And rather amusingly, they do not sound very cataclysmic and amazing. They are chirps, is the strongest sort of a signal we'd expect to detect. And a chirp is just a tone of increasing pitch.
Right.
And what this represents is the in-spiral of a pair of neutron stars, or a pair of black holes towards each other. Remember earlier we talked about the slow decay of the orbit of a pair of neutron stars as they orbit and as they throw out gravitational waves. Well, this procedure, this throwing out of gravitational radiation and the decay of the orbit, will happen for many tens of millions of years. And eventually, of course, these neutron stars will get very close together.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, as they get closer together, they throw out gravitational waves with much greater power. And so this evolutionary shrinking of the orbit gets much, much faster. And in fact, the last few thousand orbits happen in a few seconds.
Right.
And the waves which are produced, therefore, sound like a sinusoidal pure wave of increasing pitch, and actually also of increasing strength as well.
Right. So the frequency goes up and the amplitude goes up.
Indeed.
Right.
Yeah. And of course, this begins at a very low frequency. I mean, it begins at pretty much the orbital frequency of the system, so that might be 100 days at the beginning. But by the time it reached the end, it's a hundredth of a second.
Right.
And the signal will sweep through the detector band, because, of course, our detectors only work between about 50 hertz and a few kilohertz.
Mm.
So we just see the end of this in this enormously long chirp, which has been happening for hundreds of millions of years. Okay, so if you had a pair of neutron stars orbiting each other, relatively close together, end of their orbital evolution, then they'll produce gravitational waves in the audio band, and so they would sound something like this. Okay, and here's a waveform where the neutron stars, which are inspiring towards each other, each have intrinsic spin, and this affects the orbital evolution, so that makes the waveform sound a bit like this.
So these are simulated, the audio representations.
They are not the real thing, unfortunately.
Not the real thing.
Yes.
So we're waiting for a strong gravitational event near to us before we're going to detect these gravitational waves. When do we expect this to happen?
Are we hoping in vain? Well, it could be now. It could be tomorrow. The question is, what's the probability? And this has been looked at rather carefully, of course, because we don't want to be wasting our efforts here. We have to have some indication that there's a reasonable chance of detecting a real in spiral of this sort in the next few years. And all the indications are right now from observations of neutron stars in the galaxy is that the rate at which these events happen is such that with our sensitivity, we wouldn't expect to see more than about one every 3 years right now. So it's not a high rate right now.
Mm-hmm.
This last 12, we've been observing now for about 12 months at the Zion sensitivity. The chances of us therefore observing anything within that period are slim, but not zero.
Right.
And if that was all we were hoping to do, then I think we couldn't justify the effort. But it's not all we're intending to do. These detectors are the precursor of the real detectors, if you like, which will come online in a few years' time, which are the advanced detectors. And these advanced detectors will have 10 or 15 times the sensitivity of the detectors we have at the moment.
And where are they going to be?
Well, they'll be in the same place. They'll be in the same mechanical arm tubes which we have now, but all the optics will change and some of the control electronics will change. It's an upgrade, essentially.
Right. Is it just the optics that's being upgraded, or are you making it bigger?
Higher power in the laser as well.
Right.
But the arm lengths are the same. That's not going to change, because that was a large investment of effort to have those arms constructed. Now, a factor of 10 or 15 in sensitivity doesn't sound too much. You think, well, perhaps that'll only increase the rates by a factor of 10 or 15.
Mm.
In fact, that's not how it works. The reach, how far away from us we can detect one of these in spirals, increases as the sensitivity. So if we increase our sensitivity by a factor of 10, we increase our reach also by a factor of 10.
When you talk about reach, you're talking about actual distance away from us.
Exactly that. And so the volume of space, which we can see, increases by a factor of 1,000.
Right, yes.
How far away can we see these things? We're seeing them out to, right now, about 15 megaparsecs, which is, in light years, something like 50 million light years. That's a long way, and yeah. It includes a large number of stars, obviously, extragalactic stars. The event rates, how often we expect to see one of these in spirals for an advanced detector, is perhaps three a day. So something between three a day and three a year.
So you expect, for instance, these in-spiraling neutron stars colliding with each other. Mm-hmm. You expect to hear three of these chirps, these audio representations, per day.
We would, well, that's our upper limit of how often we could expect to hear them. I think in practical terms, you'd expect to hear them every few weeks or every few months.
Right.
But all the evidence we have at the moment is that they could turn out to be as often as three a day.
Okay.
So that will be much more spectacular, and that's when the real astronomy begins.
What are we going to learn? What are we going to learn from observing these gravitational waves when we do it? Because it sounds like it's going to happen. It's just a matter of when. The equipment's all ready to go. You're running the test experiments now, precursors to the main event. Mm-hmm. What are we going to learn?
Well, in the short term, we're going to learn that Einstein was right. Now, perhaps we already believe Einstein was right, but it's great to know that he really was. So I think there will be enormous celebrations and the excitement when these gravitational waves are first detected. Mm. But after that, of course, that's when the real science begins. And there's a wide range of astrophysical sources which can produce gravitational waves. But if we just highlight the one we've been talking about, which are these in-spiraling neutron stars, one important thing about the way in which the radiation is produced is that these objects can act as what are known as standard sirens. Now, what's a standard siren? You're about to ask. A standard siren is an object which has a known brightness.
Right.
So, in other words, if you see how bright it looks, you can work out how far away it is.
Hmm.
Why is it called a siren? Well, it's because of this chirp thing. It's because it's an increasing frequency to the signal. So these standard sirens are objects of known luminosity. We know how much power they produce, and we can work that out simply from the rate of change in frequency and from other aspects of the waveform which is produced. So if we know the luminosity, then we can work out how far away they are. And of course, in cosmology, this is rather important because anything like that helps you to determine the relationship between how far away things are in redshift.
Mm.
And that's stuff which tells you about the shape of the universe. And so you can answer questions about dark matter and dark energy and all of the current issues in observational cosmology. And so that's for the future. And that will produce observations which are very important just purely in terms of observational and cosmology. But of course, they also reveal the structure of time and space around these objects which are inspiring. So you can have a look at small variations in these waveforms which depart from what we expect. If you had a really pure system, perhaps comprising a pair of black holes orbiting each other and inspiring, because black holes ought to behave in much the same way as the neutron stars we talked about earlier, then one can imagine a really clean arrangement there, where you just have a pair of isolated black holes in spiraling. And those will probably produce a waveform which is very close to the one which we expect.
Right.
If you have a pair of neutron stars, though, they'll have perhaps they'll have strong magnetic fields, obviously, most certainly. They'll also perhaps have material around them which is accreted. And so as they approach each other, things will get very complicated.
Right.
And so from the evolution of the waveform from those, we should be able to tell a large amount about the environment around neutron stars, and also the structure. What's the inner structure of a neutron star? And these are all questions which are very hard to answer in any other way.
Hmm. Very exciting stuff. So hopefully, in a few years' time, there will be a CD from the LIGO Consortium, The Sounds of Our Universe.
I look forward to that too.
Thank you very much indeed for taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure.